June the 26th, 1979. And of course, the last lesson in this month. Now these months roll around fast. We have been doing a series in the book of Genesis. And we have now gotten down to chapter 11 and ready for verse 8. Chapter 11 and verse 8. That's right, it is 4. I was looking at the wrong thing here. We ended up with 4, I think, the last time, but we'll have to kind of review that just a little bit and then get it going on about 5. So chapter 11. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick, and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. That's what man's going to do. In fact, it sounds here as if he says, let us go up. So, that's what man is always trying to do. And we'll find an opposite for that in a little bit. Now, of course, we have figures of speech in here. The Lord, it doesn't have to say the Lord came down as a man to see the city and all of that. But it is given to us to understand his action. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. Well, now he'd been seeing it all the time, but now he's inspecting it with something else in view. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. I ought to be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth, both over with the command given to Adam and Eve, and then the same command given to Noah and his sons. And these people are not going to go out and replenish the earth, but they're going to congregate in one place, build a city, a tower, and make a name for themselves. And of course, that has been, I guess, the goal of most of mankind since that time, is to make a name for themselves. And it seems that those who have least tried to make a name for themselves are the ones who have made a name for themselves. Ever think of that? Well, the Lord, you know, said that the greatest in the kingdom of heaven be the one who would be a servant of all. And so the men who forget self and do service are the ones who become great. Now, Moses could have made a name for himself, relatively speaking, if he had stayed in Egypt and possibly inherited the throne, because he was adopted son of the king's daughter, and he might have been in line. But Moses wouldn't have ever been mentioned near so much if he had done that, as it has been since. Moses' name is all through the Bible, is known all through the world, practically. He is a great lawgiver and so on. Moses is known yet today, after all these years. Paul, who might have stayed in the Sanhedrin and been a famous man of his time, which he was. He was a great teacher of his time. But not remembered today for that. He remembered for the fact that when he saw the Lord on the Damascus Road, he was willing to say, what wilt thou have me to do? Not what I will do, but what wilt thou have me to do? And these people were not interested in what God wanted them to do. And so they're going to do something for themselves. And as we said last week, they use brick for stone and slime for mortar. Substitutes all the way through, and that's what man does. He doesn't build of everlasting materials as God does. And the tower had a great deal to do with the city. and was in, had a circle on top for the signs of the zodiac as an object of worship. And so they begin to do something for themselves. And the Lord says, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. It about looks like that today, doesn't it? And so in verse 7, God says, go to. He's going to say the same thing Ed said twice now. Go to. Let us go down. Not up, but down. God is always going down to help people. Like a use judgment or something. Of course, that's to help those people. Let us go down. And there confound their language. Twist their tongues. That they may not understand one another's speech. And of course, you know, well as I do, if I have to scatter them in a hurry, I don't know of anything he could have done much better to scatter them than that. Because some people can't understand each other, or they're going to get away from each other. And so all the little groups who had the same language or tongue would get together, and out they'd move somewhere, and another group would move out in another direction, and so it was. Now it has been the business of a great many of our historians to go back and get all of the records they can and so on to find out more about this migration from the land of Shinar, because that has to do with the nations that are on the earth today. And we can, in general, just tell just about where each of the nations came from and what one of the sons of Shem, Ham and Japheth, they came after as part of some of the nations. But the scattering did not occur until some years after the flood and at Babel. Babel, and we get the word Babel from that, the babbling brook. And people babbling when they are making a lot of noise or saying nothing. That's easy to do, talk without saying anything. But Babel also means, Babel means also confusion. And of course, babbling brook, that does sound like confusion as far as any message and so on is concerned. And so Babylon is a place of confusion. Their tongues are confused. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build a city. They never got it finished. And of course, that's another characteristic of man, isn't it? He's always starting something, but how often does he finish? Therefore, the name of it is called Babel. Confusion, because the Lord there did confound the language of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Now how long it took to make all of that scattering, whether it was immediate, whether it was later, and how long it was until they were scattered among the Indonesian islands, the Philippines, South America, Australia, New Zealand. We haven't any way yet of definitely giving dates and so on these. The history is too confused. He got confused too. Now we have a break here at the end of verse 9. It takes up the generations of Shem. And then the generations of Terah, the father of Abraham. And maybe it's a good idea to look through these generations. Now, Shem was the youngest of the three. Japheth, Ham, and Shem. And it was through him and his seed that the earth was to be blessed. Of course, that narrowed down to Abraham later on. That narrowed down to Esau, or Esau, but Isaac. From Isaac, it narrowed down to Jacob. And through his 12 sons and his 50 grandsons. And so on down. Shem was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood, which would be 2346 B.C. And Shem lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years and begat sons and daughters. How many? We haven't any idea. Live another 500 years after he begat Arphaxad. Verse 12, and Arphaxad lived 530 years and begat Salah. And Arphaxad lived after he begat Salah 403 years and begat sons and daughters. Now that was about 2311. And Salah lived 30 years and begat Eber, about 2281 BC. And Salah lived after he begat Eber 403 years and begat sons and daughters. Eber, from which we get the word Hebrew, is across, over the other side of the flood. And so, that would be about 2281, and Salah begat Eber. And Eber lived 430 years, and begat Peleg. About 2247 BC. And Eber lived after he begat Peleg 430 years, and begat sons and daughters. And Peleg lived 30 years, and begat Reu. 2217. And Peleg lived after he begat Reu 209 years, and begat sons and daughters. Verse 20, and Reu lived 230 years and begat Sered, 2185 BC. And Reu lived after he begat Sered 207 years and begat sons and daughters. And Sered lived 30 years and begat Nahor. Now we're getting down to the line, aren't we? 2155 BC. And Sered lived after he begat Nahor 200 years and begat sons and daughters. And Nahor lived 29 years and begat Terah. Now, Terah would be the father of Abraham, so Nahor here would be the grandfather of Abraham. And so Terah was begotten in 2126. That's getting down pretty close to 1996 when Abraham was born. And Nahor lived after begat Terah 119 years and begat sons and daughters. And Terah lived 70 years and begat Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. And those are in the opposite order what they should be, just as if Shem's three, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Haran was the older and died before his father did. Nahor, and then Abram, the youngest. Now that ends the generation of Shem. So we get up to Abram, Nahor, and Haran. However, we take Terah here and give his generation. Now these are the generations of Terah, verse 27. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran begot Lot. That makes Lot then nephew of Abraham. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees, before they ever left the land. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. Nahor had Abram's wife of Sarah. And as we go on with the genealogies and so on, we find that Sarah was his half-sister, a daughter of Abram's father by another wife. I might add there, people have questions about marrying relatives and so on. I've explained that many times. If anybody happens to be listening who hasn't heard, no doubt, at the very start, Cain, Abel, Marissa, and so on, brother married sister. As before, the race had deteriorated to the place that that would be a dangerous procedure. But as man deteriorated physically and mentally too, this became a gamble. Because as the genes and the chromosomes began to deteriorate and you get the same kind together, you might get an inferior mentality as well as physical defects. For a number of dynasties in Egypt, brother married sister called themselves a god that would not marry with the common people. Well, they didn't turn out too badly. There were a few among the bunch that weren't so good, but where do you ever find a line of royalty without finding a few idiots among them? Study your history and be amazed. Maybe it takes that kind of a genius to get the power, I don't know. But so often, we find that world rulers especially have been men who have been mentally unbalanced. I'm not going to name any of them, you can think back and even the last 100 years or some of them. I wanted to make that explanation here because back in Abraham's time, the race was still sturdy enough that marrying a half-sister would not probably be any danger at all. And we find on later that Amram married his aunt, Jochebed. And here in this, right here, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. And so Nahor had married Milcah, and she was his niece. But Sarah, the wife of Abraham, was barren. She had no child. We wouldn't know why. Of course, God had a hand in this. He's seeing to it that his program was carried out. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarah his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. Now the daughter-in-law is actually a daughter by another wife. His son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur the Chaldees to go in the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now, of course, we have to read the first 3 verses of the next chapter here to get the background of why and the wherefore some of these things happening as they did. We're told some things there that we're not told before. Now, the Lord had said, I'll get that, at some time in the past, the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And no doubt Abram told that. And so Terah, his father, says, well, I'm going along. So that is what happened. And so Terah took Abram and his other sons and the grandson Lot, and away they went. Well, it wasn't obeying God. For Abram had been told to leave his kindred and his father's house, and he would go to a place he was showing. But he didn't leave his kindred. His father went along, and one brother went along, and his nephew went in, son of a dead brother. And further from the promise, I will make of thee a great nation. And I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. I'd like you to notice the number of parts in this promise here. Number 1, I will make of thee a great nation. Number 2, and I will bless thee. Number 3, and make thy name great. Number 4, and thou shalt be a blessing. Number 5, and I will bless them that bless thee. Number 6, and curse him that curseth thee. Number 7, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now, do you like to read something like that and count out those items? That's a good way to help you to remember them. That's a good way to study. Well, there we have the first promise made to Abram. Now, if Abram was born in 1996, and was 50 years old when he left, then that would be in 1941, when he got to Haran. And then 41, 21, you see, leave another 20 years then, till he got into the country, the land in which he was to go. Well, we can keep those in mind. Notice the date in the margin of the Companion Bible. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went to him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. All right, now we've got it, 75 years when he went out of Haran. So he stayed 25 years in Haran altogether. And that'll make up for some of our figures that we had. Abram, I notice this verse 5. And Abram took Sarah his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the soul that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. And into the land of Canaan they came. See how emphatic that is? And if Abram was doing things now, not Terah. Terah's gone, he's dead. So Abraham now is going ahead and obeying the command that God had given him. Verse 6. And Abram passed through the land and to the place of Sychem. I don't think that it's pronounced Sychem. Unto the plain of Moreh. And the Canaanite was already for them in the land. This takes us back to chapter 6, 4 of Genesis, where after that speaks about the false seed coming to the earth. And after that, after the flood, and here they come. And when Abram gets into the land, the false seed are already there. Now, whether that 25-year delay of his allowed that, or whether they come in before that, I'm rather the opinion that it was longer than 25 years that they'd gotten into the land. But even if Abram had come straight from Ur of the Chaldees into that land, I think he'd have found the Canaanites. They weren't quite that new there. And then you'll find, as you go on through the history, that in addition to these Canaanites, the Amalekites came up from the south down from the Arabian Peninsula and settled southern part of Palestine. And that was what, part of what the Israelites were up against when they came to Kadesh Barnea. Not only were the Canaanites there in the land, but the Amalekites, the old enemy of Israel, settled in there too. And so they were scared to go on in. That'd be something to come out when we get to that part of the story, if they ever do. Now, verse 7. And the Lord appeared unto Abram, and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. Notice, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord, who appeared unto him. Now, this is about the first altar we hear of after Noah made one after the flood. So this is about the second altar we hear of after the flood. And that was quite a long time. And he removed from thence into a mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent. Now, Bethel means house of God. And Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he built him an altar in the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. So here's another altar. And Abram journeyed going on still toward the south. And you see, he hasn't had any revelation given to him yet. He hasn't seen the land that God had promised to him. He just told, after he got into it, that land God had given him, but didn't give the extent of it. And so we have to go on to the story and find out what happens and how it happens that Abram finally does know all of the land that's going to be given to him, the extent of it. But he's traveling toward the south, and I wonder if he should have been going on instead of settling there at Sychem. Pretty good location. Of course, there are other problems that aren't mentioned till later on. Abram and Lot had gathered quite a bit of wealth in the meantime, and they had flocks and tents and herds and so on. And living a nomadic existence like that, it was quite likely they had to move from one pasture to another, keep on moving. How much trouble that the natives of the land gave them, I don't know. It doesn't tell us very much, except in once in a while, in extreme instances. We have to sort of read them between the lines once in a while. Of course, we don't dare to do too much of that. But we do know something of the type of people in that country and how they lived at that time. Well, he got down to the south of Palestine pretty well, and there was a famine in the land, verse 10. And Abram went down, down, down into Egypt to sojourn there. And I think that was a mistake. He there stayed in the land and fed by ravens and going down in Egypt and getting in trouble. For the famine was grievous in the land. By the way, if you take your concordance and look up the famines that are mentioned in the Bible, you'll find there are 13. 13, an evil number. Rather interesting little thing along the way. And so because there was a famine, I think most of the folks who are listening know what a famine is. It just means that they're famished because they have without food. That's where we get the word famished, from famine. And the French has borrowed a word from this to mean hunger, and it's faim, F-A-I-M, faim. And it came to pass, when he was come near to enter Egypt, that he said unto Sarah his wife, now notice this, you know what he does here reminds me of Ananias and Sapphira. Does that ever remind you of them? So he says to Sarah, behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. He must have been beautiful if he mentioned it. Husband doesn't often tell his wife that she's beautiful, does he? A fair woman to look upon. Now, had Sarah adopted the Egyptian way of living and not covering her face, the Egyptians and women did not cover their faces, but the Chaldean people and all of those up in there, the women with their faces covered. That is, they saw their eyes peeked out with a cloth across their nose and covering the lower part of the face, and a turban, whatever they wore on their head, covering their head. And so he goes on, therefore it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save her alive, or thee alive. They will kill him and take her for wife, see? So say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee. A little plot. Now, it's a half-truth with these half-sisters. But sometimes a half-truth is worse than a whole lie. I kind of think that Abram is kind of taking advantage of his wife there, too. He's not all lying, but he's bargaining with her that she should lie. Isn't that it? In fact, it looks as if he was almost ready to trade her off for his wife. And it came to pass, when Abraham was coming to Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman that she was very fair. Now, I don't know how fair she was. You see, that would be all relative. Coming from the line of Shem, she probably was not near as white as the women who come from the line of Japheth. The Jews are not as white. The Semites are not as white as those from the Japhetic line, as the usual thing. But for her time, at least, she was very, very fair. Now, the Egyptians themselves at that time were of the Negroid race. They also were from Canaan, from Mishraim, or brother of Canaan. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her. And of course they started talking. And they commended her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he entreated Abraham well for her sake. That is, he thought he had a prize. And Abram, her brother, why, he gave him a lot of property and wealth and so on. Because here was a wonderful woman. And so he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. Abraham was really getting rich. Why, he had practically sold his wife, hadn't he? And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. I don't know what happened to them, but we have told them they had a lot of trouble. So here was a woman that brought trouble. And really a lot of trouble. I want you to notice the difference between the character of Abraham here, or Abram, and Sarah. Which one was the more righteous? And Pharaoh called Abraham and Abram and said, "What is this that thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she was thy wife? Why saidest thou she is my sister?" You've got some whys here. "So I might have taken her to me for wife. Now, therefore, behold thy wife, take her, and go thy way. Get out, I don't want to see you anymore." And so Abraham and his tribe were kicked out of Egypt. Now, I don't know if the famine was over yet or not. It doesn't say. And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that they had. Lucky, wasn't it? Back in those times, men didn't always have that good of luck when they displeased a king of power like Pharaoh. Well, the Lord had a finger in it. He's preserving that true seed from which the Redeemer, Shiloh, should come. And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all he had, and Lot with him, into the south. One of his relatives is still hanging on, and so he promised that was made to him when he was down in Ur of the Chaldees has not yet been all fulfilled. He has not yet been shown all the land that he should inherit. And Abram was very rich in cattle, that is, all kinds of domestic beasts, and in silver and in gold. Now, Palestine didn't have silver and gold, so evidently he had amassed some of that in Egypt. So they had gold down there and silver. And he went on his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, under the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai. So that's where it belongs, maybe. Under the place of the altar, which he had made there at the first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. That isn't worship. And Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now tents, of course, was staying there for what was in the tents. His wife, his servants, and a lot of the stuff that he had as well. Tents, tabernacles. And the land was not able to bear them, that is, both of them. There just wasn't enough pasturage that they might dwell together. For their substance was great, or their wealth was great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle. They began to fight over the pasture. And notice the parenthesis. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwell then in the land, and they had their share too. It doesn't seem that they've come into a fight with them yet. And Abram said unto Lot, "Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren." For we be brethren. All the same family. So let's don't fight about these things. So just watch you just go away. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. Now, why is Abram giving Lot the choice, the first choice, instead of he himself making the first choice? I think there's a good reason there, because there's plenty of evidence that Lot was older than Abraham, even though he was a nephew. For Abram's older brother, Haran, had died before his father did, and must have been a great many years older than his brother Abram. And so, in deference to age, Abraham would give Lot the first choice. That would be the custom. And Lot lifted up his eyes figure of speech, isn't it? He lifted up his eyes. Well, how did he lift up his eyes? It's like a little old joke he had a number of years ago. The fellow couldn't drop his eyes, so he had to go and get an eyedropper. And here he lifted up his eyes. Well, we use those figures of speech. You want to be careful so you don't just stop and take one literally at the wrong time and then get the wrong impression. That's what people do sometimes with the Bible, and they can certainly get things twisted when they take something like this and literally. Now, you just can't imagine yourself seeing Lot standing out there on the hillside and taking his eyes in his hands and lifting them up way above his head. I'm laying this on because I know the tendency among some people to get a start a new notion, a new ism, a new idea just from such a foolish thing. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan. And that's a garden today. But it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, cometh unto Zoar. Ah, there was really a fruitful place. It's a fruitful place only today because it is irrigated. At that time it didn't need irrigation. Here's a hint here that it became waste after what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. We don't know all of what happened. We know that there was fire and sulfur rained upon the cities and they were destroyed. And there's evidence that that happened. Then Lot showed him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. He didn't go there all at once, but he started going in that direction. You know, we don't get into deep things like that all at once. Just don't go out and plunge into it. Now, again, something to be careful about. I'm anticipating the story just a little bit, but I want to bring that in here. As Sodom finally went down and dwelt in the city, and Abram always dwelt in tents. Now, it was not wrong for Sodom to, for Lot to dwell in the city. He just picked the wrong city, that's all. Lot didn't have the promise that Abraham had. Therefore, he would not be a pilgrim and live in tents, as Abram did. Abram had a promise. And he knew that promise would be in resurrection. So he lived in tents as a testimony for the fact that he was a pilgrim and a stranger in the land of the promise of him. Never owned a foot of it, except what he bought for burying place. Yet he walked up and down that land, which by right belonged to him, and someday will. As well as to his seed. Rather interesting if you take the downward steps of Lot. Now there's parenthesis in verse 13. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceeding them. Well, that wickedness which they had in Sodom and which got its name from Sodom today has become respectable, even to ministers in the pulpit in some denominations. But God's measure of it is there were sinners, there were wicked before the Lord exceeded them. Now that's his judgment on it, regardless of what men may say. And the Lord said unto Abram, after the Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward, and eastward and westward. All the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, to thy seed forever. As soon as he finally separated from all of his kindred and fulfilled all of the rules that God gave him to leave his land, leave his kindred, and so on, then God showed him the land that he said he would show him. Now, there are some things you don't see. Some things that you just have to, you know, sort of get a hazy idea of. It may be that you haven't come to a place that Abram did. Maybe you haven't separated yourself from the world. And the Lord is not revealing those things to you. There are lots and lots of Christians today who have no idea of the heavenly places. Don't even really know about them. The mystery. The dispensation of the mystery. Very few understand it. Most of them are like Lot. He never did know about it. Abraham's real possessions and so on. Cared less, probably, because Lot was interested in the present, not the future. Verse 16. I guess my time is pretty near up. Verse 16, I'll make thy seed as the dust of the earth. So if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Two dimensions, length and breadth. Later on, he gets three dimensions when he sees the holy city, or looks for it at least, the length and breadth and height. Then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. So that finishes the 13th chapter, ready for the 14th, the next time. All right, everything looks to be okay, and we can take up our second section of our evening's study. In the book of the Revelation of Jesus Christ, not of St. John the Divine. We're in the 6th chapter and finish the 8th verse, I believe. We have had so far 4 seals opened, and those 4 seals have revealed 4 horses. And they are symbolic. The first one was on a white horse, and white, and carried a bow. Now, if you look up the word bow, I don't have time to get into all these details here. We never get through this. You'll find that Israel were not to depend upon the bow, and it's mentioned a number of times, but to rely upon God. Also, the bow is seemingly a representative of Gentile rule and warfare. But the bow is empty. So it probably is an empty threat at the start. Anyhow, this man rides a white horse, and his crown was given to him. Somebody gave him a crown. He went forth conquering the conquered. Now, who gave him the crown? I don't know. There's some information that possibly Satan did, because it gave him his power and authority. The second beast was red. Well, I don't know whether I've seen sorrel horses, that's almost red, I guess, and bay horses, and that isn't exactly red. Well, here is a horse that is red, probably red as blood. And this horse, a power is given to take peace from the earth. People should kill one another. He's given in him a great sword, so here is war. The third horse, black, with a pair of balances, the hand of the one sat on it. And we find here that it is famine. And there's an estimate that according to the prices that are given here for just the necessities of life, that they have gone up close to 800% above what the ordinary price would have been at that time. And the fourth beast was green, pale green, with